Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now from the Queen City of the Plains.
Welcome to Denver. You look excited to be here.
Next stop, you know, South Bell Flight.
I love Baraka, what he's about, all about the change and hope.
You guys staying cool?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo are the hallmarks of the new U.S. gulag Democrats are helping to create.
Today is a celebration of our faith and our values. In the best tradition of the Democratic Party, today we honor and respect our differences while striving to find our commonality.
I'm actually a Hillary delegate, so I'm going to vote for Hillary. But I'm not a Puma. Just vote Democratic. Unite. We can't make any mistakes.
The Denver Indian Center's intertribal dance yesterday. Before that, we heard a little of the DNC's first ever interfaith meeting and a delegate referencing Puma, the breakaway Hillary Clinton group, party unity, my butt. The Democrats are here. They have a freshly minted vice presidential candidate on his way. Senator Ted Kennedy is here in Denver, but it's not clear if he's going to speak. We're at the Pepsi Center, the convention's home. Joining us is Michael Tomasky, U.S. editor of The Guardian. Michael, just you are in Denver. First of all, what's been the reaction to news that Ted Kennedy is here?
I think it's been very excited among the delegates, among the handful of people that I've spoken to about it. And of course, you know, he's beloved by the kind of people who will be at this convention. And if he does show up on that stage, I think it'll be a very emotional moment for people.
What is the sense that the rift in the party between the Clintons and the Obamas is going to be healed this week, which is their major goal? We're reading in the Denver Post that Hillary Clinton will allow her delegates legally to vote for Barack Obama. She has to make that statement, but many aren't going to in the roll call on Wednesday.
Yeah, I wouldn't look for that rift to be healed this week. You know, 20 to 25% of her voters still say that they'll vote for John McCain. That's a very high number, and for Obama, an unacceptably high number. He's got to get that down to 5, 6, 7%, which would be more normal. And this is not going to happen overnight. It's going to take some time. Hillary herself can help the process along, of course, but I really don't think that many of her voters will agree to go for Obama until they've thought more about this race and the stakes in it.
Well, remind us, you know, why the Democrats picked Denver. Ed Quillen writes in the Denver Post that lore has it that in the 1883 trial of the so-called Colorado cannibal, Alfred Packer, the judge, who was a Democrat, said, "You voracious, man-eaten son of a bee, there were 7 Democrats in this county. You ate 5 of them." I mean, it's such a Republican state. In fact, Republicans afterwards here in Colorado had Alfred Packer clubs, each member pledging to dispatch 5 Democrats. You know, I mean, it was such a Republican state, but it's turning.
Yeah, I'll have to Google that. I didn't know about that. That's a great story. I think what happened here in 2006 did a lot to persuade Howard Dean and other Democratic leaders that they should have their convention in a state like this. In 2006, Colorado elected a Democratic governor for the first time in a long time, and the state's House of Representatives delegation switched from majority Republican to majority Democratic. It's one of those states that demographically is trending toward a more, I wouldn't call it necessarily liberal with a capital L, but toward a more moderate progressive point of view. And so, you know, it was a good choice in that respect, I think. You know, if you look back through the list of cities where Democrats have had their conventions since Roosevelt's time, it's almost always on either seaboard or in Chicago. So this is a change and a good one, I think.
Michael Tomasky of The Guardian here in Denver. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Well, just decades ago, the party that is readying this week to nominate the country's first African-American president turned away a group of black delegates. In 1964, Mississippi didn't allow black delegates, so former sharecropper Fannie Lou Hamer led an alternate party, the Freedom Democrats. They traveled by bus from Mississippi to the convention in Atlantic City, where she made a televised plea to the party's credentials committee, in which she described how blacks like her were beaten and jailed if they tried to register to vote. And then she said,
"The Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now. I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you.
Well, the Democrats were offered two seats, but Fannie Lou Hamer rejected that, saying, "I didn't come all this way for no two seats." She also said, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." 4 years later, in 1968, Hamer returned, this time as an official delegate. She died in 1977. Well, Lawrence Guyot was chair of the Freedom Democrats, working with Hamer. He was also a delegate in 68. And he joins us now from Washington for a look back. Mr. Guyot, what was the impact of her televised testimony?
The speech was so effective that Lyndon Johnson called a press conference to interrupt it. At that time, we had three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, all of whom played her speech in its entirety. 1,200 telegrams poured in saying, "Seat the Freedom Democratic Party." And we did it with panache. Fannie Lou Hamer was a person who firmly believed that America could be made to be as great as its expectations. And she fought courageously, and it led to the changes that now lead to the nomination and the election of Obama.
And just a little more about Fannie Lou Hamer, who paved the way. She was 44 when she stumbled onto a meeting and learned for the first time that she could vote. She was one of 20 children, a sharecropper.
I was at that meeting. Fannie Lou Hamer was a leader on the plantation system. Fannie Lou Hamer was a religious fundamentalist who knew the Bible as well as anyone, who was a brilliant speaker, who had an excellent sense of timing, who could develop five themes and bring them all together in 15 words at any time she wished. She was one of the best political advocates in American history.
Well, and I'm looking again at the speech. Here she is telling about beatings. I laid on my face and the first Negro began to be beat. I was beat. I was exhausted. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over, pulled my dress. And here she is sitting with her hands folded, doing her testimony with her little white purse on the table there. Mm-hmm. What happened to Americans? This was one of the first times they'd heard of what happened in the South.
We must remember, in 1964, a person could travel from Mississippi and to Atlantic City and never find a public bathroom they could use, never find a hotel they could register, never find a restaurant that would seat them. Let's be clear, that's what we were talking about in that period of time. The civil rights movement in Mississippi, which was simply the most creative in America, was committed to bringing America into the fight and bringing the federal government into the fight. Fannie Lou Hamer's speech did that. So let's be clear. We're poised now to do the same thing, but I think there's enough momentum in this country to elect Obama. My concern is that we turn this campaign into a crusade. If I were running his campaign, we would have freedom days throughout America. We did that in the South.
And what do you mean? What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is we pick one day for our state, and the total concentration of everyone supporting him is geared toward voter registration, political rallies, and planning to turn out the vote in November.
How have you felt about Barack Obama's words to the black community? We're remembering the recent appearance where several young black men stood up with a sign that said, "What about the black community, Barack?" And
I think that Obama, I was glad that he handled the attack exactly the way he did. He was very specific in his response. He made sure that the young man was heard, that the audience did not simply side with him without dealing with the discussion on the merits. Let me tell you something. I've spent my life doing this. There's no fight I have not been in. I was in the fight for 18-year-olds to vote. I was in the fight for women to vote. I was in the fight to stop the war in Vietnam. And the one thing I've learned in all of this is that the beautiful thing about America is that there's nothing that can't be done in the political arena, and there's nothing that will ever be done in America that is not political. If we set out to design the perfect candidate for this time, who's been able to bring blacks, whites, Hispanics, gays, and straights together and with a firm commitment that the America he envisions is one that is inclusive, indigenous, that is issue-oriented, and that we can be proud of. The beauty of him is comparable to the beauty of Fannie Lou Hamer. Both were able to speak to people directly about the universality of politics and the ability of politics to transform and empower people's lives. That is what I would expect of a great leader, and that's why I support him unequivocally.
But there are points where you differ with Barack Obama, for instance. That
one is very clear. Barack Obama does not support reparations.
Right.
And once I read a book called Slave Nation by Alfred Bloom Rosen, it became clear to me that the Constitutional Convention was designed to protect slavery, that slavery was a federal program that was carried out and implemented by the federal government.
And we've reported quite a bit on that here on the program. There was just sort of a reinstitution of slavery in corporate form and, as you said, through the prison system, et cetera. And so you believe there should be reparations.
I'm committed to two things. One, I'm committed to doing everything possible between now and November 4th to elect Obama president. I'm just as committed to making sure that this great country of ours pays its historical debt on what is the national sin of slavery.
What are your thoughts, though, about people who might say, analysts who might say, this is exactly the kind of talk that might lose Barack Obama the election, because many Americans are afraid of that.
Let me be very clear. Americans are too great to allow their fears of any issue to really denigrate their place in history. America is a country whose economy was created on the backs of slavery, but it is now moving to open up the political process to everyone. I don't pretend to speak for Obama in my support of reparations. Obama is running for president of the United States. He's not running for president of the NAACP. But I want to be very clear. I want to repudiate openly those young people who support Obama, who talk about this period as a post-civil rights era.
Or post-race.
A post-race. That is ludicrous. I thought your question would be, what about those people who say, well, my grandparents didn't own slaves? My response to them is, this was an American federal policy defended by the Constitution. There was no other way to produce a fundamental economic basis for America other than slavery.
That's lifelong activist Lawrence Guyot. In 1968, he and Fannie Lou Hamer were among the first black delegates from Mississippi to be seated at a Democratic convention. And by the way, here in Denver, we're noticing that Michelle Obama has taken to the stage. She's getting ready for her speech tonight. We'll get some thoughts about that later in the program. And we're also going to be back more with Lawrence Guyot. Later today, the New York Times says to get a glimpse of what the Barack Obama presidency might look like, you might look to the Massachusetts governor. We will. We'll speak with Governor DeVos. Patrick, find out what advice he's giving Obama, with most newspapers reporting that Democrats are more nervous than they were a few weeks ago because John McCain has erased Obama's lead in national polls. We'll be back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now from Denver. We're back with more from Lawrence Guyot. He and Fannie Lou Hamer made history in 1968 by becoming among the first black delegates from Mississippi to be seated at a Democratic Party convention. But we understand you're not going to be at the convention this week because of financial concerns. And, I think that's got to be tough not to be in Denver.
I'll tell you why it's not tough. I am convinced that the Obama campaign began in Mississippi, that the idea of taking on what seems to be impossible odds. What could possibly be more impossible than taking on the state of Mississippi in 1964, when its entire policy was apartheid? The policy of the Democratic Party in the state of Mississippi was, we support segregation. The policy of the Democratic Party in 1964 in Mississippi was to support Goldwater for the presidency. So when we talk about impossibility, let's look at this first-term senator who dares to take on what seems to be impossible odds, and he's turned the impossible into the pragmatic reality that is just days away from us. So I have made my contribution.
Mr. Guyot, where are you going to be Thursday night? And how do you think you're going to feel?
I'm going to be very proud. I'm going to be having a sense of completion. We contributed the lives of people. We created civil rights martyrs to bring this about. This will be America at its greatest. And I call upon every one of you who ever supported Fannie Lou Hamer, if you helped us in Mississippi, help us with Obama.
Lawrence Guyot, one of the African-American Democratic delegates seated at the National Party Convention with Fannie Lou Hamer in 1968, an activist before and since. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick will deliver a speech in primetime tomorrow night. He's only the second African-American to be elected governor in the country, the first in Massachusetts, and a national co-chair of the Obama campaign. The two men share a decade-long friendship, a campaign strategist, David Axelrod, campaign phrases like, yes, we can, and advice. Well, we caught up with Governor Patrick yesterday and asked, with a new CNN poll showing Barack Obama tied nationally with John McCain, what advice would he give Obama this week?
Well, be yourself. Ignoring the polls is key, because I really believe that what the country wants is leadership, but authentic leadership. In other words, leadership that's willing to speak the truth as you see it, and take the consequences.
Well, for instance, he's recently said that he would consider compromising on offshore drilling,
right,
something he's against. He doesn't think it's going to provide the oil that's needed in the time that it's needed. That's angered a lot of his backers. Now, you are someone who's taken on issues that have been criticized in our state, casino gambling, something you're for, something many of your backers are against.
Well, there are going to be compromises. I mean, but I think that if you make, you know, there's the compromise, which is about political expedience, and there's a compromise because someone actually persuaded you to think about something differently. I think Barack Obama is a person with enough inner rectitude and a political backbone and also an intellectual self-confidence so that he can hear differing opinions and acknowledge the validity of them. And by the way, I think most of the public are in a place where they want a politics that says we don't have to agree on everything before we can work together on anything. That polarizing, you're either with me or against me, kind of behavior is what has gotten us into a lot of the mess we're in, and I think that's what an awful lot of the American people have had enough of.
How do you feel about Matt Bai writing in Sunday New York Times Magazine that to get a glimpse of the Barack Obama presidency, we should look to you?
Well, I read that article. I mean, that's Massachusetts is important, but this is, after all, the national stage.
Well, you know, your critics would say you came out of the box, just a fantastic victory in winning the governorship, and now you're being criticized. A lot of your major efforts, I mentioned casino gambling, property tax relief, didn't go over well. And this is in a state that has a Democratic legislature. Some critics would say, yes, look to the Deval Patrick governorship, because while there was a lot of excitement in the beginning, there hasn't been that much implemented. And they apply it to Barack Obama, that he would have the same result.
We just completed the most productive legislative session in, what, 30 years? I say, yeah, sure. If that's the example you want to hold up, go ahead.
We have also spoken in this program to Lawrence Guyot, who was the civil rights activist from the 60s, about whether or not Barack Obama's nomination means that we are a country that's post-race. He says, absolutely not. Where do you weigh on that?
Race is with us, but it doesn't mean that it is, in every case, the obstacle it has always been or has been in our past. Barack Obama is the nominee because he earned it. Now, it ought to tell us something that we are sitting here in Denver on the eve of his formal nomination by one of the two major political parties, that the country has come some distance. It doesn't mean race is gone.
Well, then you've spoken about this, that you have been put in the position of being the black oracle. Have you advised him on what happens if
he's tested? Well, we've talked about that, but, you know, you could have that conversation with almost any black person who has had a position of some significance, whether it's a political position or business position. You know, you're always asked to be the commentator. Mm-hmm. But the point is that Barack Obama is not trying to be something he's not. What he's trying to be is more than the occupant of the little box that people sometimes want to put other people in.
What will he face, as you have said you faced, having to get across to people, look, I'm representing the entire country and not just some, one special
for some,
interest.
And there will be a whole set of additional expectations that previous presidents haven't had in this country.
We spoke to young Kenyans here who fully expect he will change what's happening in Kenya. I mean, it's putting a lot on his shoulders.
I think the expectations are enormous, but I also think that they have something to do with how much yearning there is in this country and around the world for positive, visionary leadership.
Do you and Barack Obama, in those moments where you're just hanging back, both came from, you south side of Chicago, him single mom, poverty, food stamps, and here you are at this convention.
Isn't it a great country? I will tell you, we don't have a lot of kicking back moments lately, but that's what I want to try to talk about on Tuesday. There is something so unique about the American story, and his story and mine and countless others who are in that hall and who will be watching and listening have experienced the American story and are hungry to have the next generation experience it. And I think that is the choice before us right now.
Governor Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now from Denver's Pepsi Center, where Wednesday night the Democrats will hold a roll call as they nominate Barack Obama. Tonight, at the request of Obama, delegates from Michigan and Florida will be granted full voting rights, despite holding early primaries against party rules. And many of those delegates will cast their vote for Hillary Clinton. Now, the Obama campaign hopes to heal the rift with Clinton supporters. Former Virginia Governor Mark Warner is the convention's only keynote speaker, but Clinton will probably steal some of his thunder when she speaks right before him tomorrow night. And the Obama camp has extended another olive branch. We bumped into Jim Roosevelt, the co-chair of the party's Credentials Committee. He told us the Obama campaign has asked the Rules Committee to review the day-long primary caucuses system.
He asked that the way that caucuses are conducted be re-examined.
Because it's the Clinton campaign that complained that the caucuses favored a candidate like Barack Obama because the Clinton voters were older or couldn't get off 9-to-5 jobs, whereas the Obama candidates you're nodding yes could be young people who could come to the caucuses.
Senator Obama heard the Clinton campaign's complaints and said this does deserve to be re-examined. His message to the Rules Committee even mentioned that they should look into having absentee ballots for caucuses so that those in the military and those who work shifts and are taking care of children can participate.
Jim Roosevelt of the Democratic National Committee. Well, state delegates have had to do their own healing. We're going to follow a group from Montana this week. Montana, one of seven states with the minimum 3 electoral votes. It's been reliably Republican. This year it's being described as a swing state. Barack Obama will be in Billings on Wednesday, the day before he accepts the nomination here in Denver. Well, we caught up with 3 Montana delegates at their hotel. Carol Williams was a staunch Clinton supporter who will be a Clinton whip at the convention. We asked what that means.
Well, I think what Hillary was very conscious of is that she wants this convention to move well. She wants us to come out of it united. She wants to make sure there aren't little problems that might come up on the convention floor. And the purpose of the whip structure is just to go around and be sure that the convention is working well.
You don't expect to be talking anyone off a ledge because Hillary Clinton isn't the VP?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And I don't think we're going to have extra votes. I've been getting calls from some Obama people in Montana saying, you all are going to go down there and try and steal this from us. And it was none of that.
You told us that if she were the VP.
Yes, it would have helped. And I do think, I will admit to having been very disappointed when I learned that it wasn't going to be her.
Well, you're sitting right next to Dennis McDonald, another delegate from Montana, former personal injury lawyer, cattle rancher now with your family in Montana. You've been on the program before. We tried to get you to tell us which candidate you were for. Now you will say that you are a staunch Obama supporter, and you made some calls to Clinton supporters, but why were you making calls?
Well, out of respect. You put your heart into it. I know how it feels, and I just have a lot of respect for the family and, of course, a lot of respect for Carol.
Well, then on the other side, Carol, we have Anthony Jackson, 26, and the only African-American delegate from Montana. Is this your first convention?
It is. I'm more interested in seeing the organization and mobilization of people to get them excited for the election, not only in the presidential level, but on several levels. I think that'll be the biggest thing that we can do at this convention.
Well, especially Montana. Let's stay with that. I think only two Democrats have won in presidential races in Montana since 1940-something, and one of them was Bill Clinton, and that was because Ross Perot split the vote. And yet, Montanans are talking about possibly the state turning blue.
One thing that I always say, I've born in Montana, I've lived here my entire life, one of the most open-minded, just good people who will judge somebody based on their character that you're going to find. I think anywhere you go, you're going to have people who have racial issues, but I think that's Montana is going to see very little of that. So I don't think that he's going to see the resistance in Montana that he may see in other states that have a lack of African-American population.
Well, look at Nevada and some of the other western states that where John McCain is pulling ahead. What do you think Barack Obama has to do in the West?
Well, I think Barack Obama has understood from the beginning of his campaign what he had to do in the West. He's been very active out here.
In fact, George Bush won by 20 points in 2004. They're saying the fact that Barack Obama came to Montana and was here four times is what did it in Montana.
Well, I think that's right. And it's not just that he came, but he talked about the issues that people care about in Montana. I think we care that people cared enough about us to come out and talk with Montanans, listen to our concerns, and come not just once, but going to be five times this week. He's going to be back there again.
I'm sure you all have a friend with a pickup with a gun in the rack on the back who's afraid that if the Democrats get in office, he's going to lose that hunting gun. I mean, what do you say to them?
I have a gun rack in my pickup. My sons and daughters enjoy hunting. It's part of our culture in Montana. Senator Obama, when he's been in Montana, he spoke to that issue. He bought some radio time. We're not going to let it become a wedge issue in Montana. As a matter of fact, this donkey that we appreciate as Democrats once in a while needs a little kick in the derriere.
We want to know, what do you hope to tell the party?
I want to express that it's bread and butter issues. It's single mothers that are struggling to put food on the table. We in Montana, food prices have shot up 20%. Fertilizer costs that are through the roof.
Carol, you've been nodding. Are you also wanting to hear more specifics?
I am wanting to hear more specifics, but I do think what I think is wonderful about the Democratic Party at the place where we are right now is that we have recognized that the Rocky Mountain West is an important part of our ability to win electoral college votes.
There's one additional thing it occurred to me, and that's the commitment of our young folks. They've invested heavily in this campaign, their hearts and souls. I have two boys. My oldest is home now running the ranch. My youngest boy, our baby, is a junior at Montana State. And I see these kids now investing themselves in this process for the first time in many, many years.
I want to go home after this convention to talk to all the young women who were not Obama supporters, but in fact supported Hillary, who need to be encouraged now to say this is it didn't happen the way we thought it was going to, but this is the next step, and next time maybe it'll be different.
It seems as if, Carol, this is a very fresh issue for you.
Well, I said to my son the other day, he said, "Mom, when are you going to get over it?" And I said, "You know what? I may never get over it, but I am moving on. And I am going to work really hard for Barack Obama. It's the most important thing for my grandchildren that happens." But with the subtitle of, "Don't ask me if I'm going to get over it, because I'm probably not." But I am going to be a big supporter of Barack Obama after I cast my vote for Hillary.
Well, we'll be there with you when you do. So thank you all for letting us hang with you this week. Thank you.
Yes, thank you
very much.
Dennis McDonald, Anthony Jackson, and Carol Williams, members of the Montana delegation to the Democratic Convention, will follow them all week. But this note, the New York Times reports today that delegates are being given daily talking points from the Obama campaign, instructing delegates what to say when talking with the media. One memo last week reportedly urged them to downplay any Clinton-Obama tension. They could say something like, "I can't wait to hear Hillary Clinton talk about the future, and I'm excited that her candidacy is unifying our party." Well, Carol from Montana, we just heard from, she apparently hadn't gotten the memo. You're listening to Hearing Now. when Michelle Obama takes the stage live here in Denver tonight. Her mother, Marion Robinson, will be in the audience. Family didn't give her pointers. Brother Craig told USA Today, "You don't give my sister advice." Well, what supporters characterize as Michelle Obama's confidence and directness, critics say is elitism, negativity. She's been called unpatriotic. But she's also wildly popular. She wore a $150 dress on The View, and it sold out the next day. She comes from humble roots on the south side of Chicago, attended Princeton, then Harvard Law, went on to a lucrative job at a law firm in Chicago, which she left to work for Mayor Daley. Now she's a vice president of community and external affairs at the University of Chicago Medical Center. We're going to be hearing a lot about Michelle Obama over the week, but we'll begin today with Ebony Magazine. Harriet Cole writes a profile for the September issue. Harriet, what do you expect Michelle to say tonight?
I expect her to be passionate about America and about her husband. And I say that because my experience of her is that she is incredibly positive, very down to earth, and practical.
Well, you say down to earth as she soars almost 6 feet above it.
Which is very interesting.
Well, let's just stay there for 1 second. How has her height affected her, do you think?
Well, I asked that question. I asked her mother, because a lot of tall people, and I'm a tall person, can feel uncomfortable in their skin. And I just didn't get that from anyone. I didn't get it from Michelle. I asked her. Her mother said she always stood straight and tall.
Never shy. Never, you know, always seemed to have a bead on where she wanted to go. Her brother went to Princeton. She's going to make sure she got into Princeton, too. People said she should play basketball because she was tall. And because they told her she should play basketball, she didn't.
Right. Interesting, because Mrs. Robinson said about Craig, you know, he was recruited by many schools before he decided to go to Princeton, and he was going to go to another school because he was offered a full scholarship. And Mrs. Robinson explained that her husband said, "Why would you go to X or Y school?" And he said, "Well, because, Daddy, then it wouldn't cost you more money." And Fraser Robinson said, "Don't insult me. You are a smart black man who also is a great athlete. If you go to a school that doesn't say that you are intelligent when you come out, your intelligence will never be known. Go to Princeton. We'll pay for it. That's our job."
Michelle Obama's mother was a secretary. Father, who had multiple sclerosis, was a city worker.
He was a city pump worker. And interesting about him, he was ill for much of his life. And Mrs. Robinson said that there were different points as his disability took on that she thought he was going to retire. He didn't retire. He got whatever vehicle he needed. At a certain point, he was in a wheelchair. He never allowed his disability to stand in the way of taking care of his family. And that is the sense of passion and commitment that I get from Michelle.
Let's just talk just a little bit about her as a woman and someone who talks about not wearing stockings because she didn't like them, they're uncomfortable, and, you know, being compared to Jackie Kennedy for the large pearls and kind of the impression that she makes as a woman.
There's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, many people call her the epitome of the American dream, coming from humble beginnings and being able to realize a level of wealth and comfort and joy in her life. At the same time, when you are strong and capable and independent, you're often feared. When Hillary Clinton was running with her husband for the first ladyship, the first go-round, she was criticized in a very similar way because she was smart, she was capable, she was independent.
But she's also a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And for someone who is strong and forceful and comfortable in her own skin, is there, you know, a different slippery slope that she has to navigate if people perceive her as, you know, the code word, uppity?
Actually, the image that's a classical image of a black woman like Michelle, who's passionate and smart and all these great things, is the angry black woman. And I've heard that a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's put on somebody who stands up for herself, who says, "I require that you listen to me." And Michelle does require that. I think that early on in the campaign, she was probably more raw in that requirement than she is now.
Harriet Cole, creative director of Ebony Magazine, who has a profile of Michelle Obama for the September issue. Harriet, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And as I said, we'll have more about Michelle Obama over the week. But coming up next, the Democratic Party is going to honor its liberal lion. Be back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now at the Democratic Convention, where a tribute is being paid tonight to the liberal lion of the U.S. Senate, Ted Kennedy. The Massachusetts senator is in Denver today, may address the delegates. If he does, it'll be the first time the party faithful have seen him since he began his bout with brain cancer. Kennedy is the second longest-serving living senator, perhaps the most beloved and vilified at the same time. For years, he's been the Republican poster boy for tax and spend liberalism. He was first elected at 31 in 1962. It said his brother, JFK, asked a friend to hold that seat until Ted was ready. As the 60s progressed, of course, the terrible Kennedy family history unfolded. JFK and brother Bobby assassinated. Then the drowning death of Mary Jo Kopechne in a car driven by Ted Kennedy in Chappaquiddick on Martha's Vineyard. An inquest found Kennedy, who left the scene, didn't report the accident until the next day, liable for Kopechne's death. And, of course, his presidential hopes were then gone. So what will his legacy be? Marty Nolan began covering politics for the Boston Globe in 61, the year before Kennedy became senator. He joins us from the studios of KCBS in San Francisco. Marty, don't we have to start with Chappaquiddick? It was way back in 69, but it's the thing in the way of many Americans hearing anything else about Ted Kennedy.
Well, of all the events in his life, this one certainly marked him and, in a funny way, humanized him. I mean, everything had been perfect, except, of course, having his brothers assassinated, but he was sort of a golden boy, and this was a bad moment. He knows it, admits it. He confessed on television that he wasn't capable of being president because he couldn't make a decision. That's pretty serious, big stuff.
You covered Kennedy for years. How would you describe him in full?
In full. Well, a heck of a guy, charming and diligent, all too human. I mean, he had weaknesses, booze and misbehavior. But all obscured, I think, by the record of diligence and the scope of his interests. Every conceivable domestic policy and international policy has been influenced by him since 1962.
Tick through some.
Minimum wage. The minimum wage to people who aren't on it or near it isn't a very important issue. But believe you me, it is. Every year he tries to raise the minimum wage, and every year the critics say, oh, it's going to wreck the economy, and it never does.
Well, and some of the things that Ted Kennedy fought very hard for were successes at one time and failures at another. I'm thinking of campaign finance reform, and even some of his immigration policies have shifted over the years.
Yes, they have. He was in favor of a military draft. I don't think he is anymore. You know, that's the nature of Washington life. But others, he fought for peace in Northern Ireland. He attacked Lyndon Johnson's policies and Richard Nixon's policies in Vietnam. Somebody had to do that.
Well, with all the legislative accomplishments, someone say, well, maybe even, you know, despite Chappaquiddick, there might have been a chance for him to also occupy the Oval Office. But what an ill-fated run for president in 1980. He ran sort of a disorganized campaign against incumbent Jimmy Carter. He couldn't answer a simple question put to him by, I think it was Roger Mudd.
It was Roger Mudd on CBS Reports, yeah.
He was asked why he wanted to be president, and how did he respond?
It was all babble. You could put it on as a nightclub sketch, you know, or just double talk and gibberish. But you check him on C-SPAN on any bill in which somebody is trying to do damage to poor people. Now, there's eloquence, because it's not scripted. He doesn't have three speechwriters going over it. He's not citing Ralph Waldo Emerson or, you know, Thomas Jefferson. He's speaking from the gut, and it has its effect. He has a way of dealing with people as people. He tells jokes, he relaxes them, and he has many deep personal friends among very conservative Southerners. When he got there in 1962 as a legacy, as they say in the Ivy League, they did not like him. And a few months later, they did. I think his mind is always on what people are talking about at the kitchen table. I'll bet you he's read fewer pollster printouts than the average politician today. You know, so many liberals love the people and don't like people. He's not one of them.
Well, you know, he's very much here. He will be very much present, you know, in the party tonight. But he leaves a big hole in the party when he finally does step down.
Oh, of course. Enormous. Well, you think of all the famous people. Webster, Clay, Calhoun, Norris, Taft, La Follette, so forth. Well, you know, you add up all of their accomplishments and what they actually got done, and they don't match Ted Kennedy's.
Martin Nolan covered politics for the Boston Globe from 1961 to 2001. He's been speaking to us from the studios of KCBS in San Francisco. Thanks so much for speaking to us.
Okay.
Well, we want to close today with Greg Moore, editor of the Denver Post here in Denver. Greg, thanks so much for being here. And I'm holding up your paper, and there's the big, beautiful front page with a half-page picture of these young protesters shaking their fists, very angry yesterday. But I love your caption. Marchers were so well-behaved much of the time that they waited to cross streets with the green lights.
Yeah, yeah. I actually had a chance to see some of the protesters going down Colfax, and I thought on a scale of 1 to 10, it was about a 3. They were very well behaved. And I also think that the police presence was just so overwhelming that no one really wanted to get out of line.
Well, we have spoken to people, and we're going to be hearing from Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. There are some very disgruntled Democrats about the war in Iraq, we've heard about different decisions about Hillary Clinton. So we'll maybe be hearing stronger voices over the week, but they've been muted so far. But, you know, remind us, here we are in Denver. Mm-hmm. Give us the broader picture of what this says about the Democratic Party that they're here and what they need to do here.
Well, I think that the Democratic Party has increasingly been defined as a party of the left coast and the right coast. And I think that the party is looking to capture the interior West, and that they have a better chance of broadening their party by doing that than trying to contest across the South. That may come later. I think there's a 50-state strategy. But for starters, I think they have a better opportunity with a Democratic governor in Montana, a Democratic governor in Colorado to sort of turn this thing around.
Well, but, you know, the Democrats are bragging, and some would say, you know, rightfully so, that this convention is going to be the most diverse in history.
Mm-hmm.
44% of delegates, minorities, half women,
mm-hmm.
More young people than ever.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering how those images are going to play out in this area. Yes, Denver is very progressive, and Billings, Montana, but we're staying in a motel 45 minutes out of town. The only channel they carry outside of the three networks is Fox. There is no CNN.
You know, the interior West, and particularly Colorado, is almost 33% Republican, 33% Democratic, and 33% independent. But, you know, Denver had a Hispanic mayor like 17 to 20 years ago, an African-American mayor for 12 years. There's a lot of progress being made, and the interior West attracts people from all over the country. And I think you get a different attitude and a different sensibility. I think it's going to play well.
Well, and we should say for our listeners, you are an African-American man, and you've been saying to me, in the breaks,
mm-hmm.
you know, look, people are very accepting in this area. They're sort of mm-hmm. beyond that. We heard that from the Montana delegates
as well.
True.
It's very, very true. I worked on the East Coast for a long time, and people here don't ask what school you went to. They don't want to know what neighborhood you're from. They want to know, do you like to hike? Do you like to fish? That kind of thing. And it really makes a difference, and it's very easy to get assimilated in places like Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico.
Well, I have to say, and people who are seeing Denver this week, who maybe haven't seen it in a while, or since the last convention 100 years ago when it was a cow town, what a beautiful city with amusement parks as part of the skyline.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great party on Saturday night.
We'll be bringing listeners some sound from that tomorrow. There's an amusement park here that Damon Runyon mm-hmm. attended the press mm-hmm. Party there 100 years ago, so we'll have that for you. And we're going to be speaking to you again, Greg Moore, editor of the Denver Post during the week. Thank you so much.
It'll be my pleasure.
Well, thank you for joining us here in Denver. We're going to be back. And remember, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy is going to be perhaps speaking tonight. We'll bring you all the news from the Democratic Convention here in Denver. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.